Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello and welcome back to The Critic podcast. I am Ben Sixsmith, and today I'm delighted to be joined by the excellent Christopher Snowden. Christopher Snowden writes for The Critic, but he's also head of lifestyle economics at the Institute of Economic Affairs and the author of many fine books, including Killjoys and The Art of Suppression. Christopher, how are you today?
I'm not so bad, considering, Ben. I'm okay.
That was a very world-weary affirmative answer.
I am. Lots to be weary about, I would say. Yeah.
You often write about nanny statism and prohibitionism. I mean, I was thinking before this podcast, it's a term I used to hear all the time in the days of New Lab and Tony Blyer, but it seems to have kind of faded from prominence. Do you think that's because the phenomenon it described has faded from prominence, or somehow the terminology has moved on?
Well, the phenomenon it describes definitely hasn't faded from prominence. It's become way more prominent since Tony Blair's day. Yeah, you're right. People did used to go on about Tony Blair being nanny state and so on. But if you look back at his record, what actually was nanny state? Well, the smoking ban was the big thing he did just before he left office. And he kind of restricted some food advertising during children's TV. But I can't think of anything else. And in fact, he liberalized the laws on gambling and alcohol. He was, you know, did some of the most libertarian stuff anyone's done in this country for decades. But at the time, some of the things he did felt kind of nanny-ish. And there was this kind of, he did sort of seem to introduce this idea, if you don't like something, you can ban it. And that's probably not a fair thing to say, because obviously lots of governments have banned things basically because they don't like them. But with fox hunting, which, to be fair, he wasn't particularly bothered about, to say the least. But yeah, his government did ban that, despite, you know, doing an evidence review that found actually this was not the most, you know, not the worst way to keep control of vermin. Anyway, yeah, no, you're right. He got this reputation. I don't know. I mean, the term nanny state to me always feels a bit too soft. I mean, when that term was introduced in the 60s, I think it was initially over 70-mile-an-hour limits on the motorways. And it was about, you know, campaigns to tell people to maybe think about stopping smoking. And people said, well, this is a bit nanny state. And over time, it's got to, you know, a very coercive level. And now we're talking in Britain very seriously about actually banning the sale of tobacco and even cigarette papers to anyone who's born after 2008. So in a sense, it's too soft a term. The phrase bully state has been suggested as a more accurate word for it. But actually, I find the people in public health, and it's usually people in public health who are pushing this stuff, they really get annoyed if you use the term nanny state. So I just keep using it just for that.
But the actual kind of prohibitionist instinct, I mean, I think unarguably it's become a stronger one. It feels like every week we're talking about banning something. Whatever the merits of the particular ban. Recently, we've had disposable vapes, smoking outside bars. I guess, obviously, it's a more debatable one, but ban on certain breeds of dogs. What do you think is the primary drivers behind this kind of prohibitionist impulse?
With the public health stuff, I think it's a symptom of having unserious people in charge of government, really. I think there's two giveaways that the people who are leading you do not really have much of a vision, and they can't deal with the stuff they really should be getting on and dealing with. For example, you know, building reservoirs and nuclear power stations and houses. And that is, firstly, when they just introduce targets. There's been a lot of that in Britain over the years, recent years, I mean. So you have the smoke-free 2030 target, which says we're going to reduce smoking rate below 5% by 2030. There's also a little known halving child obesity target by 2030, which is never going to be done unless they actually just start measuring child obesity properly. That would more than halve it straight away. You've got net zero, of course. You've got the petrol car ban, which is 2030 now, 2035. In the EU, it's 2035, just about. You know, various targets which are just left to one successor to try and implement, and nobody really knows how to do it in practice. So you've got that is one symptom of unseriousness. And the other one, I think, is just general desire to micromanage people's lives. It seems to me that Rishi Sunak's policies really don't come down much to much more than, you know, if I like it, it should be mandatory. If I don't like it, it should be banned. Right. So he really likes maths. It's something he has in common with Liz Truss, incidentally, the obsession with advanced mathematics, which in practice is totally useless to anything more than a fraction of 1% of the population. But he really likes it. And so he wants to make it mandatory in schools until the age of 18. He doesn't like disposable vapes because he's got 12-year-old kids who, you know, he's worried that they might start vaping. And he really doesn't like smoking, so he's going to get rid of it. But on any objective measure, these are not even in the top 100 things that government should be worrying about. It's a sign that we're led, I think, by political pygmies who, maybe to Rishi Sunak, disposable vapes may well be one of the most important things, the most threatening things to him. But, you know, he hasn't realistically got very much to worry about, has he, you know, as a billionaire.
Mm-hmm. Certainly true. Let's talk about a couple of these phenomena individually. One of them are cigarettes. I mean, we're talking about plans where they'd kind of raise the minimum age for cigarettes, so eventually it would become impossible to smoke. Nobody could smoke at all. And which kind of is quite comical to imagine 34-year-olds kind of sending their 35-year-old friends into the corner shop to buy a packet of cigarettes.
Challenge 75 schemes in shops.
It'll become a very big compliment. You know, you don't look a day older than 39. But do you think there's any future to the cigarette? I mean, let's look 25 years into the future. Will anybody smoke tobacco? Or do you think these measures will be successful in just driving it out of the public space?
Someone will be smoking tobacco, for sure. It's a very popular product historically. You know, the cigarette, in some senses, is the most incredible product of all time, because even when everyone knows it's really bad for you and it's been taxed at incredible levels and you can't advertise it, you can't even display it behind the gantries in the shops, millions of people keep buying it. You know, I think globally, the number of people who smoke hasn't actually gone down at all. I think it's still about a billion people. Obviously, population growth is partly made up for that. The actual smoking rate's gone down a bit, but not much. You know, people have been smoking tobacco as long as they've had access to it. The moment that Christopher Columbus's men came across tobacco, they got straight into it. And of course, the people they were nicking it from, the Native Americans, have been smoking it for God knows how, we don't even know how long, but thousands and thousands of years. So it's not going to disappear. It's going to decline for sure. And nicotine consumption will definitely continue in some form. Could be vaping, could be nicotine pouches, could be, I don't know. I mean, there's lots of different ways you can deliver nicotine in principle. But yeah, people will still be smoking. It'd be a niche thing probably. But look, I mean, people are still very much smoking cannabis. They're doing every type of drug. So Sunak's idea, you know, his vision, you know, this is going to create a smoke-free generation. Well, we haven't got a cannabis-free generation. We haven't got anything-free generation, really. And we're never likely to. So the question is, are we so bothered about people smoking that we want to set up a new front in the war on drugs? Because we know that prohibition will not eliminate whatever it prohibits, as long as there's any level of demand for it. And there's no reason to think there won't be, you know, there will be zero demand for tobacco. And if there was zero demand for tobacco, why would you bother prohibiting it, right? You know, it might become, it's possible it might become obsolete, but probably not. So, you know, is it really worth all the hassle of the problems that you get with trying to prohibit things, you know, the criminality, the funding of terrorism, the general disrespect for the law? It just seems so pointless when smoking is declining more or less naturally as a result of people like myself switching to alternatives like e-cigarettes.
Yeah, and I mean, it might even introduce a kind of subversive glamour to cigarette smoking, which has kind of died off since.
I think it genuinely will. Yeah, I really, you know, even if I was a young person who had absolutely no interest in buying cigarettes, I would still feel discriminated against. You know, I'm born in 2009, and this person who's born in 2008 can smoke and I can't. I mean, it's just seems to me intergenerational unfairness, of which there is already quite a bit in society. And just on the basic level of, you know, rights. I know people aren't going to fight for the rights of 14-year-olds, you know, today's 14-year-olds to ever smoke cigarettes, but they will be adults. And quite honestly, I don't see why my daughter shouldn't have the same rights as I did growing up.
A lot of young people nowadays, they do smoke vapes, disposable or otherwise. As someone who's a kind of geriatric millennial and still sometimes smokes cigarettes, I kind of have this nasty impulse to look down on it because the big plumes of smoke just look a bit silly and smell a bit sickly. So if they really were terribly unhealthy, I'd almost have a kind of schadenfreude. But I don't quite understand from the arguments for banning them why they should. Is there kind of solid evidence that they might have significant health consequences, or is this just a kind of, so this is new, so it must be bad?
Well, look, I mean, the consensus view, certainly in Britain, is that they are vastly, vastly safer than cigarettes, but not safe. And no one has really been able to pin down where the hazard is in a normal regulated vape, I should say. Obviously, you know, you can put anything into a vape and that could cause problems. There was the Evali thing, so-called Evali problem in America in 2019, where people were vaping actually THC cartridges, but they were contaminated with something called vitamin E acetate, which literally killed people, you know, caused severe lung damage and killed dozens of people. So yeah, there are things you can put in a vape that can be dangerous. There's a long list of substances that are banned across the EU and the UK, which are at least potentially dangerous. So I think, you know, unless we find some particular chemical going in a particular vape juice, I think we can be reasonably confident they are safe enough, let's say, certainly safe enough for somebody who used to smoke. I've been vaping for 13 years now. I feel a hell of a lot better for it. I don't cough at all like I used to. And I'm quite happy to be used as a guinea pig. But, you know, why? No one is actually saying these things are 100% safe. So let people get on and use them. The level of public understanding of the relative risks of vaping and smoking has gone backwards in such a scandalous way in the last 10 years. People literally were more knowledgeable about the, you know, relative hazards and safety of e-cigarettes 10 years ago when they didn't know anything about them than they are now when they've been mainstream products for a decade and there's endless research about it. And that is shocking. You know, I think there are now more people, even in Britain, where health agencies have trying pretty hard to educate people about this. More people think that e-cigarettes are as dangerous or even more dangerous than cigarettes than correctly understand that they are much less dangerous. And that is a huge failure of public health messaging. It's a result of deliberate misinformation from various groups, a lot of them associated with the World Health Organization and Mike Bloomberg, quack scientists over in the Bay Area of California who just keep pushing out this incredibly misleading research in which, you know, you just find some poor animal and you douse it with formaldehyde or something, you know, and say, oh, well, there might be formaldehyde in vapes, and, you know, this zebrafish died when we poured vape juice all over it, so, you know, don't vape. And in fact, implicitly go back to smoking, you know, better the devil you know. I know people who've gone back to smoking on the better the devil you know basis. That's pretty shocking.
You think scientists in San Francisco would have bigger drug problems to worry about with that research in vapes as well? I mean, it's not exactly short of issues to cover.
Well, yeah, but again, it comes down to being unserious and not wanting or not being able to deal with the real problems that society faces. And so you end up not just going after smoking, which is a kind of legitimate health risk, but you're actually going after something that is getting people off cigarettes. And that strikes me as not being just illiberal, which the whole public health movement is, but downright counterproductive on its own terms. And these people really should be ashamed of themselves.
And I mean, it shouldn't be the main message, because obviously the main message, if you oppose this kind of prohibitionism, is, you know, fundamentally it's not your business when there's this low level of risk. But also, if they did ban vaping, surely there'd be a heightened risk of kids messing with the kind of actually dangerous stuff which hasn't been regulated. And
Yeah, and that's another point that's overlooked. I mean, it's not just that kids in Britain and elsewhere are illegally buying vapes, in that it's illegal to sell a vape to a kid. The vapes themselves are very often illegal. A whole load of unregulated vapes are currently being dumped on us by the Chinese, where they have their own flavor restrictions, actually, which means that they can't sell these vapes in China. And yeah, they're not regulated. They do contain heavy metals. And so we've got a situation in which illegal vapes are being sold illegally to children. No one's doing very much about that. Instead, we're talking about even more regulation and let's stop selling, yeah, Rizzlers to people who are currently children but won't always be. And, you know, let's restrict flavors, which is a terrible, terrible idea because that'll push so many people back to smoking. It's just a complete mess. And we're run really by blinkered idiots.
Do you think the authorities prefer to make new things illegal rather than going after actually illegal things because it's just easier to target the people who are generally law-abiding than to go after, you know, hardened criminals?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, basically that's true, yeah. I mean, the governments for a long time now in my lifetime have been keener on legislating than governing, you know, which is to say enforcing the rules that already exist. And the, I mean, when we're talking, you say hardened criminals, I mean, a lot of the time we just need to clamp down on basic, you know, the legitimate corner shops who are just turning a blind eye to this, right? So these people aren't going to put up that much of a fight so long as trading standards turn up there with the threat of a £10,000 fine and ask to see what vapes you're selling. So actually it's really quite straightforward to clamp down on this. But, you know, again, for whatever reason, it doesn't happen. There's better headline to say we're going to ban these things altogether, even though, as I say, they're effectively already being sold on the black market, and the black market is only going to increase. But to get back to your previous question, you know, we should really be just standing up for people's rights to vape per se. I mean, in a sense, it's been a successful but short-term strategy by the, you know, pro-vapers, whatever you want to call them, to say, well, this is one of the great health innovations of the last 100 years, and we're pushing down the smoking rate. Because although that all that is true, you will relatively quickly move on to a situation which we're already kind of seeing, where more and more people who are vaping are people who've never smoked. And at that point, you've already conceded that these things aren't 100% safe, and 100% safety seems to be the benchmark now for everything. And in a way, it's not surprising you then get this moral panic about young people vaping. The fact that a lot of them would have smoked otherwise is completely ignored, because, you know, we're down to 1% now of 11 to 15 year olds smoking regularly. Even 10 years ago, it was like 8%, you know. And people, yeah, of course, people were worried about, you know, teen smoking in those days, but there wasn't like a constant panic about it like there is now with vaping. But it takes someone with some balls really to say that, all right, we don't really want these kids vaping, but they would have been smoking otherwise. And actually vaping is like the least worrying of all the things a teenager could be doing. Vaping is the mildest thing. Same with laughing gas, actually, to slightly digress. I mean, panicking about laughing gas is barely even a drug. It gives you a tiny little high for a very short amount of time. If that's what kids are doing for a good time, I say let them do it. There are so many worse things they could be doing than, yeah, inhaling laughing gas out of a balloon. It's kind of sad that they were even doing it.
One of the big public health concerns since way back when Jamie Oliver was taking the pizza out of my school dinners has been obesity. And you've written about a new trend, because, I mean, nutritional science is so little understood, not to mention how it relates to public health, that people have never been able to quite pin down what they think the cause of obesity is. You know, you have people who think it's the carbohydrates, you have people who think it's the animal products, you have people who think it's the sugar, and a new one has been the ultra-processed foods. This is something you've written about, people trying to categorize these particularly, I'm doing little mini air quotes with my fingers, unnatural food products so that they can then demonize. But do you think there's any kind of intellectual respectability to this category at all? Is there such a thing as ultra processed foods, or is this just arbitrary?
In a sense, there is, because they have been defined. I mean, the definition is ludicrous and unscientific. And the sort of layman's definition, which actually is so close to the real definition, I think it's fine for people to use it, is ultra-processed food is any food product that comes wrapped in plastic and contains at least one ingredient you wouldn't find in your own kitchen. Now, straight away, you've got to suspect that this is not based on the most robust science. I mean, where does the plastic packaging come in for a start, right? The thing with obesity, right, obesity is obviously the next target, the most obvious target after smoking, and there's always going to be another target. There is gambling as well in there. There's alcohol in there. But as a health risk that's killing large numbers of people, you have to say that obesity is like the obvious contender. The problem is obesity is so much more complicated than smoking. And when we talk about smoking, we basically mean cigarettes, right? So you've got one product, which is the cause of a huge number of deaths, and you try and suppress it in an incremental way using all sorts of different supply side measures, some of which work, some of which don't. But it's obvious what the problem is. And in broad terms, the fewer people who are smoking and the fewer cigarettes that are sold, the less lung cancer is going to be. That nothing is anywhere near as simple as that applies in the case of obesity. Firstly, a large part of the obesity problem is people simply not exercising enough, right? The decline in physical activity in modern society, in my view, is one of, if not the most driver of obesity. But the government can't do anything about that. So then you move on to the food supply. But again, the reality is, broadly speaking, that, you know, people are eating too much. And if they ate less, they wouldn't be as fat. But that's not really very useful to a campaign group that wants to start banning the advertising of a product or put tax on a product. You've got to narrow that down to something else. And so you get these fads about carb or fats or different nutritional components of the diet, all of which obviously can make you obese if you eat too much of them. But that is true of nearly everything apart from probably fresh vegetables. But alongside this, there's pretty obviously a snobbery element to it, right? The reason that it's people like Jamie Oliver and Henry Dimbleby and Prue Lee and Hugh Fearnley Whittingstall, restaurateurs, food people, foodies, get involved with this issue of obesity is because really they're just interested in food and they think people should be eating better food from their perspective. And what the ultra-processed food thing does is it allows the campaigners to demonize factory made food. Essentially, there's always been snobbery about factory made food ever since it's been around. You look at the kind of what the intellectuals were saying about tinned food in the 1930s. Like, tinned food was one of the totemic symbols of mass consumption, and they didn't like mass consumption. And now we just got, you know, if it's wrapped in plastic, it's a pretty similar thing. But it scientifically makes no sense whatsoever, because okay, there's lots of things I haven't got in my kitchen. Does that mean they are bad for me? I haven't got emulsifiers in my kitchen. I mean, eggs contain lots of emulsifiers, but apparently they're okay. But the idea that I think there's like 60 emulsifiers, that's just one sort of category of an ingredient that you wouldn't have in your kitchen, and whole loads of other stuff too, preservatives, colorings, what have you. Now, it's possible that some of these things are bad for you in some way. I don't know. But they have been regulated and tested. It's unlikely that they are. And it's incredibly unlikely that they all are. Right, so it's ridiculous. It's taken over really from the previous definition of bad food, which was HFSS, which was high in fat, sugar, and salt, which actually, although it was way too broad and still contained lots of absurdities and led to Transport for London banning, you know, adverts that showed cheese and jam in them, at least they were looking at specific nutrients. Whereas ultra-processed food doesn't do that. Not only does it not do that, it actually effectively excludes salt, fat, and sugar, because they are three things that everyone has in their kitchen. So it's a complete switch around from what we've been focusing on for the last 20 years, which is basically sugar, salt, and fat. And now we're just looking at obscure E numbers and emulsifiers, which nobody really knows much about, but as far as we know, don't actually harm you. The one thing that combines this, you know, this idea, this concept, is the basic message that you should be making your own food from scratch, and you shouldn't be buying it from a shop, and you shouldn't be buying food that's made by, you know, Unilever or somebody.
Is that a kind of the whole ultra processed foods? Do you think that's like almost a conscious Trojan horse? Because I mean, I can see the point that if I actually bothered to cook from scratch, I probably would use less oil, and I can't see the argument about how E9385 is destroying my health. So I do think they're kind of like, if we say these foods in the supermarket are really bad, people will just go back to cooking in the kitchen. Whereas if we said go back to cooking in the kitchen, they'd think that was a bit stern and bossy.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's disingenuous up to a point. But the reality is people aren't going to go back to cooking in the kitchen. So all you're doing is making people hypochondriacs, terrifying people about food that is perfectly healthy and very often nutritionally indistinguishable from what you would make in the kitchen. And in many, many cases, actually contains fewer calories than what you get if you went to, you know, Hester Blumenthal's kitchen. I mean, decent cooks use a huge amount of butter and salt in their food, much more probably than you or I would do if we were cooking something up from, you know, from a jar. And for their desserts, they obviously use a huge amount of sugar, which is why from time to time it's always very easy for the Sun newspaper to look at some of Jamie Oliver's recipes and call him a hypocrite. Well, you're gonna be a hypocrite if you're making tasty food in a restaurant. Then it's not possible to do that without a lot of salt, sugar, and fat, and indeed emulsifiers, and in, you know, quite a few things you probably wouldn't find in your own domestic kitchen.
So do you think this kind of prohibitionism is an unstoppable force? Is it just going to keep gathering more momentum as people object to more and more faintly unhealthy things? Or do you think there could be a backlash against it where it reaches a certain point and people go, oh, I'm so sick of being lectured to?
I'm pretty pessimistic about it at the moment. I mean, I take this tobacco ban. Apparently it polled really well. This is why Sunak suddenly put it in his conference speech, having never even mentioned it before. It polled quite well, particularly with people who voted Conservative in 2019. I don't think we'll get to this situation, by the way, where it's like 37-year-old can buy cigarettes, 36-year-old can't. Way before then, the anti-smoking groups will go, well, this is a bit silly that a 20-year-old can buy them and a 19-year-old can't. Let's have a level playing field and stop everyone smoking. That's how it will go in practice. At which point you will then get pretty unignorable evidence of the problems of prohibition, and maybe there'll be a backlash. But we've had unignorable evidence of the problems of prohibition with drugs for 100 years, and there hasn't been that much of a backlash. Okay, some countries are legalizing cannabis bit by bit. So I don't really see it. I mean, it seems to me that this stuff is not sufficiently unpopular for any mainstream party to say we've had enough of it. I mean, the tobacco ban was imported from New Zealand, where it was a Labour policy under a particularly, you know, authoritarian Labour Party, you'd have to say, with Jacinda Ardern. And it had already been mooted by Wes Streeting, the Shadow Health Secretary. And as soon as Sunak announced it, Labour said, yeah, we're gonna whip our members to vote for this. It's going to be a free vote for the Tories. The Lib Dems, I mean, it's exactly the kind of policy you'd expect from the Lib Dems. They're going to love it. The Green Party loves it. I don't know what Reform think or Reclaim, but I mean, it's going to might be your only choice if you want to vote against this kind of stuff. This stuff has cross-party support. It's the same with all the net zero stuff and the climate change stuff. You know, regardless of how practical it is or how expensive it is, this stuff has cross-party support. So the outlook is pretty gloomy. All I would say is it's a lot tougher to introduce this stuff when you've got 80% of the population consuming the products, as you do with alcohol, than it is when you've got 13% of the population consuming it, as in the case of tobacco. And we haven't seen much in the way of anti-alcohol policies in England, at least, for the last 20 years. We've seen minimum pricing in Scotland, but Scotland have got their own, the SNP have got their own sort of incentives to create, you know, a distance between England and Scotland on that issue. And also that it's inherently more authoritarian than any statist, as indeed Mark Drakeford is in Wales. He's possibly the worst one of all with his 20-mile-hour speed limit. So, you know, in short, I think it is possible that there will be some kind of backlash, but it's not obvious to me what form that would take at the moment. I don't think I'm completely howling into the void with this, because I do know a lot of people agree with me. But it's looking pretty grim at the moment. It does feel that it's hard to think of anything that a politician couldn't announce in terms of interfering with people's freedoms, not just in the area of lifestyle regulation, but free speech and all sorts of other things too, that the public wouldn't go along with. I think support for it, just finally, I think support for this stuff is wide but shallow. I think people could change their minds if they realized there was a cost to them, or actually there were more unintended consequences than they thought. I don't think there's that many people who are massively passionate for this kind of stuff, which is why there's no grassroots activism in favor of it whatsoever. All the pressure groups that lobby for this kind of stuff are state funded, and most of them wouldn't exist without state funding. So it's not like there are millions of people going out and, you know, signing petitions and making demands on the government. It's just Jamie Oliver and a few tiny little pressure groups. But there isn't, at the same time, very large base of opposition to it either.
So if you have an unhealthy habit in your life, you better enjoy it, because the bully state could be coming for you next. Christopher Sloan, thank you very much.
Pleasure, man. Always a pleasure.